from Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Forced labor is already unconstitutional. And what is forced birth other than forcing a woman to labor against her will because allegedly the state has an interest in that? Guess what, folks? Just because the state thinks it's important doesn't mean that they can force you to do the work for the state without pay against your will. The state might say it is very important that somebody pick this cotton. But you know what? They can't force me to do it. They have to find a willing person to pick that cotton. Can't make me do it. That's the 13th Amendment. Same thing should apply to abortion rights.
Hello, and welcome to Why Is This Happening? With me, your host, Chris Hayes. Well, I think for most Americans, and maybe not the majority of listeners to this podcast, but most people, and even honestly, like pretty news junkie, news consumer folks, just don't spend a lot of time in their life thinking about the Supreme Court or the courts more broadly. It's not a front of mind news concern. Obviously, people that are legal practitioners or law nerds or even Supreme Court nerds who are really obsessed with it. I should speak full disclosure that my wife is one of those people. She clerked for Justice John Paul Stevens and now is a law professor and is co-host of a podcast called Strict Scrutiny with Melissa Murray and Leah Littman, where they talk about the Supreme Court and the culture around the court. By the way, it's great. You should check it out. The broader world is like the Supreme Court's just sort of there in the background. And then every once in a while, it like forces itself on you. Like it forces your attention, right? So like a Supreme Court justice passes away unexpectedly or retires. And now there's a big confirmation battle or there's a big landmark ruling. You know, there's also an asymmetry here, which is that the right has been more focused on the courts than the left. I think that's like not even a really arguable point, both in the way that they do politics, in the way their base thinks about politics. It's both a kind of mass and elite, like both a grassroots and elite phenomenon. Now, the reason I'm saying all this is because I'm speaking to you on Wednesday, May 4th, 2 days after the bombshell leak of a 98-page draft majority opinion by Samuel Alito that would overturn Roe v. Wade. And at the high point of one of those moments, when the court is front and center in all its warts and all of its, you know, contradictions, all of its weird attempt to be both like a priest cast in robes who are hidden behind a secrecy and then go into the cave and they come out with what the oracle says, but also are human beings who are produced by political institutions and have political beliefs and often cloak those political beliefs under a specified technical language that justifies them. And also amidst this like enormous human disaster that is happening in front of us, which is the impending end of a right to safe and legal abortion in the United States, something that has been under threat for a very long time, but on a scale now that is not precedented in the last 50 years. Now, I had scheduled today's guest before all this happened because he's written a fantastic book about the Supreme Court and about the Constitution specifically, which is called Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. It came out in March, and I got to say, it's been an enormous success. Debuted at number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list. It's a great read. It's such a great combination of sort of like fury, righteous indignation, humor, and incredible erudition and brilliance. And which is not surprising because the person who wrote it is a guy named Elie Mystal, who's the justice correspondent of The Nation, Alfred Nobler Fellow at Type Media Center, and is a frequent guest on our program. So if you know him, you know exactly that combination I'm talking about. And it just so happens through incredible stroke of luck that Elie was scheduled for the podcast today, 2 days after this bombshell. And so we get to pick Ellie's brain about this enormously consequential development, which also perfectly fits with the general thesis of Ellie's worldview and his book. So Elie Mystal, great to have you on.
Thanks Thanks so much for having me, Chris. And thanks for so expertly summing up the problem with my entire career, right? I'm kind of constantly the guy screaming about, hey, the third branch of government.
Right.
Just as powerful as the other two. Maybe y'all should care. And Democrats are like, not today.
Yep.
Until it's today.
Well, let's start there, because I think one of the things that's interesting about that sort of third branch of government is I was talking about this in our editorial call the other day. You know, one of the things that makes this institution, let's talk about the Supreme Court before we get to the Alito opinion, which we're going to get to. So the executive branch, the office of the White House, like the West Wing, has several hundred staffers, and then there's a few thousand in the executive office of the president, which is in another building, and there's maybe like 1,000. All told, there's like, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,500 to 3,000 staffers. And then there's the whole federal government, which is all the cabinet agencies, which is literally millions of people, right? Congress has 535 members. If each of them have, you know, say 20 staffers at the, you know, the lowest end, right? That's 10,000 people right there. It's probably like 20,000 people all told that like make up what we call Congress members and staffers. The court is 9 justices. They each have 4 clerks.
Mm-hmm.
It's a totally different institutional texture that I think actually relates to the moment we're at in many ways than those other two branches.
It's 36 people. And Chris, the 9 most important people are there for the rest of their natural lives,
right,
which means they have no incentive to play any game, right? This is the last job they're all going to have. Most of them are going to literally die in their job. Their clerks, the other, you know, 30 or so people who have any idea of what's going on, they rotate out every year, but their entire rest of their careers are linked to the power and prestige of the justice that they served with. So you were saying, like, your wife, she clerked for John Paul Stevens, right? So, like, her career stature is only enhanced as John Paul Stevens is enhanced. So she's incredibly committed to his legacy and his virtues and making sure that people think that he was a nice guy. They don't leak. They never leak. This is not an institution that works on transparency because they literally don't need it.
Right, that's true. Let me just quickly, not to defend my wife, but let me just say this about her relationship to her justice, which I think actually relates to this. Like, John Paul Stevens has passed away, sadly. Like, I've described it before, I think, publicly. She would take a bullet for the guy. And I mean, just absolutely, like, adored, respected, loved, thought was brilliant, had incredible politics. Like, now, I think that's not uncommon. I mean, it's almost a medieval relationship, like the old form of like apprenticeship. You're by the blacksmith's knee or something. Like, it's a very, it's very intense relationship. But you're right also that in Kate's case, this is a totally like first order, uncomplicated thing. But you're also right that like the career incentives and the incentives of the institution are, you are bound to your justice forevermore. You are always a person who clerked for that justice. And that relationship means that, like, the place never leaks, total code of omerta. Everybody's, the people who are doing a lot of the work, which is the clerks, are doing it under these conditions of a medieval apprenticeship that's just so beyond, it's just not like anything else. I have to say, like, judicial clerkships and particularly Supreme Court clerkships are really not like anything else.
Which is why Washington is so bad at covering it, right? Because all of the things that Washington reporters do to cover a story, all the gossip, all the leaks, all the cocktail party, you know, I was out on the veranda and this person talked to this person who talked to that. None of that happens. None of that happens at the Supreme Court. In fact, you don't have to get a leak. You don't have to imagine what the justices are thinking because for the most part, they will tell you.
Right.
They will literally tell, you know, Congress passes a law. You have to intuit, well, why did they vote for this law? Well, why didn't they vote for that law? We don't know. We'll never know. We know for the most part exactly why 5 justices voted to overturn Roe v. Wade, or 4 justices dissented. We'll know exactly why, because they will write it down and tell us. So covering the Supreme Court then becomes less about getting the scoop, getting the leak, getting the hot story, and more about accurately conveying to the American people what these 9 heads in robes, what these 9 high priests of American law and politics, they are our priesthood, what these people are actually doing. And that's where I think the media falls down a lot, where because it doesn't have the horse race to cover. It doesn't have the kind of internecine gossip to cover. It just has the raw results of their rulings.
I think I said this before on the podcast, like it doesn't even have tape to show. I mean, this is a real problem that we have every time we do the show. At the first day of the term, I think they all get together in front of a red curtain and they take a group photo, and then there's like B-roll where it scrolls over them. And then there's B-roll of the court outside. There's nothing. There's nothing to show. And in fact, when they started releasing oral arguments, at least you can play that and you can subtitle and you have something, but that's all on purpose. I mean, there's a reason. They've been very clear about this. They don't want it to be like those other branches. They don't want it to be covered like other branches. They want to retain the mystique of the clerics in robes. They want all that because it's, again, they don't have any authority other than that.
Their entire authority is based on what the other branches will let them get away with. Let's not forget, right, Alexander Hamilton, you know, before he started rapping, was a guy who said that the Supreme Court should be the least dangerous branch of government, Federalist 78. He thought that because the Supreme Court controlled neither the army, that would be the president, nor the power of the purse, that would be Congress, because it had no guns or money, the Supreme Court couldn't do anything, because anytime it did something that the other branches of government didn't like, the other branches of government would just not fund or not physically enforce the Supreme Court rulings. And boy, was Hamilton wrong. The next time Hamilton would be as wrong, he would be firing a gun into the sky while he got shot to death. That's how wrong he was.
So this is a perfect segue to the leak, right? And to the decision, both of them. I want to talk about them both to start out with, right? Because first of all, the leak is, just to be clear, way less important than the decision. And so in ascending order of importance, let's just start with the leak, because I think it actually substantively relates to the decision and substantively relates to precisely this point of like mystique. I have no idea who leaked it, but the fact of the leak itself is an enormous peek behind the curtain that we never get. That itself, when you see all Ted Cruz and Mike Lee and all these people up in arms about it, it's because, particularly with a 6-3 court in their favor, they have an enormous incentive in vouchsafing and guarding that institutional mystique, right?
Right. The reason why the right wing is pissed is because the leak shows that the court is not better than the other institutions, is just politics by other means. And at the point where you're reversing by fiat, where 9 unelected, unaccountable people are reversing by fiat a longstanding legal principle that gives rights to people that is overwhelmingly supported by the American people, you want as much mystique as you can get, and that leak took it away. However, I do not, like you said, Chris, you don't know who the leaker is. I don't know who the leaker is. And honestly, not to toot my own horn, but like, of the people who could know who the leaker is, like, I'm one of them. I'm one of the people who might have a shot at knowing who the leaker is, and I don't have a darn clue. And the assumption is that this was leaked by some kind of liberal person, a clerk or whatever, who was horrified by this decision. I ain't so sure about that, because what I look at is what this leak does. And what it does from where I sit is lock in the hardcore conservatives to this hardcore conservative opinion. Now, if anything changes, it'll all be like, oh, they bowed to pressure. If anybody who was gonna vote for this doesn't vote for this now, oh, they just bowed to political pressure. It kind of locks in. So I think it's like this. I think it's just as likely,
yeah,
that this was leaked by somebody who was in favor of this decision as it was that it was leaked by somebody who was opposed to it.
Yeah. I mean, by the way, we're speaking on Wednesday, May 4th. And by the time this comes out, that like, I don't think it's crazy that the leaker will be revealed. Like, again, like we just said at the top of this, there's not that many people. So it's like, right? You know, we'll see.
And it's so unprecedented that you just can't imagine. Like, I saw somebody, I forget who it was, and it's bothering me that because I would like to name check this person. But whatever it was probably an intensely personal decision.
Right.
And so whatever we think the person's reasons for leaking it were might have absolutely nothing to do with why that person leaked it, because it's such a rare thing that how can we possibly guess at what motivates a person to break such a longstanding tradition?
So you just said something which I want to reiterate. And again, I'm a little bit sort of, this is a little CYA, because it may, by the time this hits the listener's ears, like we already know who it is, right? So I agree, like as likely on either side. The thing I said on the show last night, which I think holds, is that whoever it was, from wherever, wanted people to see how radical the decision is. Meaning, if it was an opponent of the decision, they wanted to blow the whistle. to say, like, this is what's coming. And if it was a supporter of the decision, they wanted to get this on the record to box those five votes into not climbing down and giving an inch off how the radical the decision is. So let's talk about the decision. Break down the basic line of argument that Alito offers here.
The legal justification for overturning Roe v. Wade is Warren Court was wrong and we're right, so we're going to do it. I was worried because I knew that the Supreme Court would take this right away in this case. That was obvious. I'm not surprised by the decision. But I was actually worried that Roberts basically would get his way and it would be a lot of legal gobbledygook that essentially overturned Roe v. Wade, but they wouldn't come out and say it. And so I'd have to spend like my whole summer trying to explain to people, like on your show, like what actually happened. Turns out I don't have to do that because Alito was so bold as to just straight up say Roe v. Wade was egregiously wrong when decided, which is amazingly stern and unforgiving and uncompromising language. He cites the alleged wrongness of Roe v. Wade in the fact that the Constitution as written never talks about the right to an abortion, never talks about this particular woman's rights. Yeah, because the misogynists who wrote the Constitution didn't believe women should have rights. So, of course, they didn't write that women should have rights to their own reproductive system. The people who wrote the Constitution didn't think that something as simple as marital rape could be a thing. Marital rape was an oxymoron, according to the people who wrote the Constitution. You couldn't rape your wife. So, like, that's how those people thought about the rights of women. Of course, the right to an abortion is not anywhere written in the original Constitution, but Alito leans on that. He's technically right as a fact. He leans on that, and he says that the older court, the Roe court, was wrong, and that the thing to do now is to let every state decide whether or not women have rights, which is just not how rights work, right? Like, it's just, Chris, people need to understand, there's a reason why states' rights is the first and last argument of the white supremacists. There's a reason why states' rights is the alpha and the omega argument. And it's because people of color, they're not evenly spread around the country. Most Black people still live in the states where their ancestors were enslaved. Most Latinx people live in border states. Most Asian Americans live on the coast. The only people who are evenly spread out throughout the country are white people. And so white men believe, and they're not wrong, that if they can just get it back to the states, if they can just get it back to a state-by-state decision, then they can blunt the overwhelming majority of the American people. And that is what Alito has played into, and that is what Alito has done in his Roe v. Wade decision.
We'll be right back after we take this quick break.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
So the structure of the argument, as I read it, right? Abortion is not an enumerated right in the Constitution. No one would disagree with that. It's not, no one explicitly says that in the Constitution. He then says, there are some unenumerated rights, right? That
right.
There is such thing as rights we have that the Constitution doesn't explicitly grant.
Right.
And that the test to figure out, basically, whether you have one of those unenumerated rights in the Constitution, which is, he takes from, I think, an 86 decision, but is sort of introduces kind of a new test that's like now going to be the test, is it deeply rooted in American history and tradition? Like, that's basically the argument, right? Like, and the answer is, okay, not an enumerated right. We all agree on that. That's not, you know, is it an unenumerated right? Meaning, is it a right that the people have that isn't explicitly provided for in the Constitution? And the jurisprudential tradition that gave us Roe is something called substantive due process, which is basically grows out of the 14th Amendment, which basically says, like, there are certain rights that we hold, that there are certain areas upon which the state just cannot infringe as a matter of the fundamental due process we are granted by, right?
So I like to explain substantive due process like this. There are rights that we explicitly have, right? And then there are rights that we have to have in order to make the rights that we explicitly have make sense. Huh. And those rights are the rights that we call are part of substantive due process. So to me, a great analogy is, you know, we all understand that we have a freedom of speech, right? That probably means that we have a substantive right to have a freedom to read, right? What if you think about it from the perspective of the founding, what good is the freedom to speech is if I don't have a freedom to read? Okay, another substantive due process.
Wait, let's just stop you right there, because that I think it's really useful. And I use this in the book, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Right.
Because, right, so the Constitution never gives us the right to read. It's right. Not in either the original text or any of the amendments.
Nope.
Clearly a state banning reading. Like, we all just grasp at almost a sort of like in visceral level, like, you can't have a free society in which the state can ban reading. So then right? The question becomes, right, there's some category of things that clearly the state can't, the government can't do, can't reach, even if we haven't explicitly said.
Right. It would be ludicrous for the government to say the freedom of speech is protected because I can read my book out loud. But for other people to read my book with their own eyes, no, that the government can ban. Of course, they can't ban that. So of course, the freedom to read is a substantive due process right that is part of the freedom of speech. Now, so you've gotten the due process argument right in terms of what Alito is saying about abortion. He's saying that, well, we can only divine what those substantive rights might be if they're deeply rooted in American history. And then he skips over the fact that for the first 150 years of American history, women weren't allowed to be a part. All right? It is not deeply rooted in American history that women are allowed to finish their sentences. So, of course, it's not deeply rooted that they're allowed to have access to their own bodies. But, Chris, here's the other thing. I reject out of hand the substantive due process argument for abortion rights as the only way to ground abortion rights. Like, Alito's opinion, 98 pages worth, all talks about abortion rights as if substantive due process is the only way to get there. That is but one of many. That is how the court in Roe got there, sure. But there are lots of other ways. For instance, in the same amendment where we find substantive due process, that would be the 14th Amendment's grant of due process of laws, we also find the Equal Protection Clause. I would grant abortion rights under the Equal Protection Clause, right? Like, if a man has access to his reproductive system during the entire time when reproduction is happening, then a woman should also have rights to her reproductive system during the entire time that reproduction is happening. I'll tell you this, if a man can take out any organ in his body that he may or may not need for reproduction, then a woman should be able to take out any organ in her body that she may or may not need for reproduction. If a man can take out his prostate, then a woman should be able to take out her placenta. It's hers. She owns it, right? So I would do an equal protection argument for abortion rights. I have some Eighth Amendment arguments for abortion rights that, especially in the situation where a woman has been raped in jail, it is cruel and unusual punishment for the government to force that woman that they have jailed, that they are literally controlling what she can and cannot do. It is cruel and unusual punishment to force that rape victim to give birth in jail or if she's in the military. So I've got the Eighth Amendment argument. I have a 13th Amendment argument for abortion rights. Because
Hot take coming in.
Forced labor is already unconstitutional. And what is forced birth other than forcing a woman to labor against her will because allegedly the state has an interest in that? Guess what, folks? Just because the state thinks it's important doesn't mean that they can force you to do the work for the state without pay against your will. The state might say it is very important that somebody pick this cotton. But you know what? They can't force me to do it.
Right.
They have to find a willing person to pick that cotton. Can't make me do
right.
it. That's the 13th Amendment. Same thing should apply to abortion rights.
So you just laid out a whole bunch of, there's an entire literature about other ways to ground the right. And I've heard versions of that, and you write about some of them in the book. The Equal Protection Clause, I think, is probably the one I've heard the most of. But the substantive due process line, just so that people are clear on the sort of jurisprudence here, right? Like, you get a line of cases that basically, you know, in Griswold, they say that the right to contraception is covered by substantive due process. We get Roe. We then get Lawrence, which is that you can have whatever kind of sex you want to have with a person. If you want to have sex with another man and you're a man, the government can't say you can't do that, can't criminalize sodomy. And then, of course, we get Obergefell, right? And all these cases are, again, they flow out of this same line of reasoning. You know, can the state ban you from reading, for instance? Or could the state require mass vasectomies of all men once they hit reproductive age, who then have to like voluntarily get them undone when they're like in a committed relationship? Like, I think we all agree, like, well, that sounds insane. can't do that. I mean, one of the entailments of this, right, that the people are freaked out about is because Roe and Casey rest on that foundation, he's taking a sledgehammer to the foundation. He's enunciating a new test for any unenumerated right that also seems, even as he says he's not doing it, to shatter all that other stuff.
Yup. Which is why that's where they're coming next. Like, there is a reason why the right wing has already priced in the defeat of Roe and has moved right ahead to the defeat of Obergefell, right ahead to the defeat of Loving v. Virginia. That's the case that allows for interracial marriages. I am not being hyperbolic. I am not being hysterical. I am accurately quoting what Indiana Senator Mike Braun said when asked if Loving should be overturned. He said yes, because marriages should be decided by the state. I am accurately quoting what Senator John Cornyn said when asked, when he said Obergefell should be overturned next. That's what the right wing is promising to do. If you learn one thing about the overturning of Roe v. Wade, please let that one thing be: believe these conservatives when they tell you what they're doing, because they're going to do it.
Braun, who got in a little hot water and then tried to walk it back, is actually more honest on this point than Alito. Because what Braun is saying is that the necessary entailment of what I'm saying as a legal theory is that Loving has to fall, right? Because he's saying, look, all this stuff is, and by Alito's own test, Loving has to fall, even though Alito goes out of his way to kind of cordon off Loving in the opinion because he realizes how noxious it is. But if it's like the unenumerated rights are the ones that pass the test of deeply rooted in history tradition, I got news for you about interracial marriage in the United States of America. Like, that's a tough nut to crack.
Can I also say, why would anybody believe Alito going forward? The man's already lied. Chris, you bring this up a lot on your show. I've seen you do it, where you point out that the jig is up. Brett Kavanaugh got in front of the Judiciary Committee and said that Roe was precedent upon precedent. Guess what? He's going to overturn precedent upon precedent. Neil Gorsuch got up in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee and said that Roe was reaffirmed countless times and that he wrote a book about precedent. And guess what? Neil Gorsuch is going to overturn precedent. So as you've pointed out repeatedly, Chris, these people have already lied to our faces. Republicans act like we were hysterical and we're just like, these people are going to overturn Roe. No, 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 they said. No, 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 they're not. They're just going to apply the law and follow the Constitution. That's what they said. They were clearly lying then. Now the lie has been laid bare, but they're going to tell me, don't worry about Obergefell because Alito promises that this far and no further. Like, am I a sap?
Right.
Like, is that what you think I am?
Let me argue on the other side for a little bit. So I want to raise the argument that Alito explicitly makes, and I think is an argument that relates to this really profound question about precedent and what, you know, what it means, right? So this is at an Anglo-Saxon legal tradition, right, about how precedent controls. It goes back, you know, thousands of years, I guess, probably hundreds of years, you know.
Let's start the clock at William of Norman.
Right? Norman conquest, right? So at common law. So, you know, and Alito makes a point, and others do, is like, look, there's clearly lots of decisions by the court that were both precedent and terrible and wrongly decided. And, you know, you could pick a whole bunch of them. You know, Plessy v. Ferguson, of course, a very famous one. Of course, that's the one that John Cornyn grouped with Obergefell.
Right.
Plessy v. Ferguson, Roe v. Wade, and Obergefell, which is like, whoa, boy. Right. So, you know, Dred Scott, Plessy v. Ferguson, two of the most famous. Korematsu, which has never been officially rescinded by the court, but paved the way for Japanese internment. I mean, there's a whole bunch of, like, Buck v. Bell is one where...
Right. We call it anti-canon.
Right. The anti-canon, right? Buck v. Bell is the enforced sterilization of people that scored below a threshold on an IQ test. So that argument, which is like, look, clearly sometimes the court gets it really badly wrong and precedent has to be overcome, I think we all agree with, right? Then the question just becomes like, then we're at this profound level of like, which gets to the heart, I think, of your book and your thesis, which is like, is the rule of law a real thing or is it not? Is it all just legal realism all the way down, which is essentially it's all politics in every single direction. Argumentation means nothing. Precedent means nothing. All of this is will to power cloaked in all of their fancy language, which I think is kind of a radical critique. Marx basically thought that was the case of a lot of like essentially bourgeois law. There's all different radical traditions and different other traditions that think that's the case. And then there are people who say like, no, it's a real thing. There's just good judging and bad judging, good decisions and bad decisions, you know, good argumentation around precedent, good overturning of precedent, bad overturning of precedent. And I feel like you oscillate a little between those two positions, like the full legal realist versus the like, some of it, this is true and there are bad actors view.
Yeah. So it's funny that you bring up the oscillation because it's just funny to me because most people act like I am all one way all the time. And I appreciate you noticing the nuance there, Mr. Hayes. So why do I sometimes suggest that the law and these institutions can be legitimate, even though I often am arguing that they are not legitimate in real time? Well, a lot of that for me goes to who gets to decide. So one of the reasons why I wrote my book, and certainly one of the reasons I titled my book the way that I did, A Black Guy's Guide to a Constitution, is that I have looked at the law from the perspective of a person that the law was designed to ignore and, in fact, enslave. And when I look at the law from that perspective, I see a lot of problems, obviously. I see some solutions, but those solutions cannot be done by an all-white judiciary or a predominantly white judiciary. Just can't do it. I can't make it work. I can't make these institutions and the idea that these institutions have meaning and value, I can't make it work if we are constantly hemmed in by the white, male, supremacist, racist traditions of those institutions. So either these institutions are capable of overcoming the white male patriarchy that they are founded upon, and that can only be shown by adding in a more greater diverse group of people involved in making those decisions. Or, as Samuel Alito would apparently have us believe, these institutions cannot ever overcome the white male patriarchy on which they are founded on. In which case, yes, then I turn into something a little bit more radical and a little bit more like, well, it's all just the will to power all the way through. And all of this fancy legal hoi polloi doesn't actually mean anything. So it's almost like I want the institution, you guys tell me, do y'all want to actually try having a real democracy? Or do you want to keep doing this bullcrap that you've been doing? Because if that's all you want, well, then I've got some other ideas about what we should do with you. But if you want to actually make a go of it, all right, let's start putting in a diverse group of people. It's like one of the things that I say, and I mentioned this in my book. One of the things is, how should we decide? How should the Supreme Court decide how much deference to give Congress? It's a huge issue. It's a huge issue in environmental law right now. How much deference should we give Congress? How much deference should we give the executive agencies when it comes to like the EPA and their decisions, right? And conservatives and liberals, both whites, conservatives and liberals, will both go on these long tangents about Chevron deference and major question doctrine. They have all got these fancy legal jargons about when we should or should not listen to Congress. I've got one. Was the Congress that enacted that law or regulation a diverse set of people? Did it have women and minorities all involved in making the decisions and having the votes? Or was it an all-white or predominantly all-male panel? Because if it was an all-white, predominantly all-male panel, then guess what? No deference. I have no deference for all white, all male. I have no deference for mammals. All right. You want to show me like, well, actually, the EPA consulted with diverse groups and women's rights groups and thought about the economic impact of the. Well, now I'm inclined to give the EPA quite a lot of deference. Mm. That's how I would think about it. But that is one of the more radical things you'll hear me say.
Well, that is radical, right? Because that's like completely anathema to the methodology that the right espouses. But even the sort of liberal response to it, right, is that kind of stuff is like outside the parameters of the law. Like we don't, that just doesn't factor into our decision, right? That we can't even pay attention to these things, like how diverse was the Congress? Like not for us to say. I mean, your point is the project of the book in some ways, right, is like we've got a constitution that was written and amended over the course of years in the context of white supremacist patriarchy, a massive disproportionate share of power held by white men that has changed over time and expanded out in different ways through lots of different changes. And that if the goal is like true pluralistic, multiracial, equitable democracy, that guiding ethos has to be at the core of like how we think about the law and can't be like outside of it while we try to like take this structure that we've been bequeathed by this history and make it work with modern pluralistic democracy.
Yes, yes. Either we understand a more pluralistic and diverse view of America, or we are an illegitimate nation. Or the people who were enslaved here are still waiting for their opportunity to break free. Look, it is simply, there is not a stitch of law, philosophy, political philosophy, economic history. There is nothing that suggests that I, as a human being, should live under laws as they would have been interpreted by my captors. That's just not a thing, all right? So either the people who captured my ancestors and brought them to this country illegally in chains, who raped various of my ancestors, either the people who did that, their idea of freedom and equality doesn't apply to me, or this is an illegitimate project. Now, the difference between me and a black radical, me and a black nationalist, is that I think it could work. We could make this work, that if we just gave full faith and credit to the 14th Amendment.
Well, that was going to be my response was like, yeah. Wait a second. But the 14th, like the fulcrum of the Constitution is the war and the Reconstruction Amendments. And like, both in a historical sense, right? Like there was the Great War over this issue. And also in the sheer radical nature of the project of those amendments, which was truly put together by people with a genuine vision and informed by freed African-American activists, writers, thinkers, critics, etc.
Well. Informed by, sure.
Not written by, yeah.
Yeah. And they didn't actually go ask black people what freedom meant to them.
Yeah, it's a good point.
And they didn't let black people have a vote in what freedom meant for them. And they certainly didn't let women have a vote in either of those questions, even though we use the 14th Amendment to also now extend equal protection to women. If they had asked women after the Civil War what equal protection might have looked like, you might have had some more economic protections, right? You might have had some more rights that were designed around the ownership of property. If they had asked the former enslaved people what equal protection meant to them, they might have included some more property ownership protections. And I know this, I'm not speaking out of the back of my behind. I know this because the very first case that came up out of the Reconstruction Amendments was a 13th Amendment case called the Slaughterhouse Cases. It was brought by white people, y'all. White people who were slaughterhouses. They were butchers. The government of Louisiana had granted a monopoly to one butcher, making all the other butchers in southern Louisiana have to like work for that one company that was granted the monopoly. And white butchers sued under the 13th Amendment, saying that their economic rights were so taken advantage of that they were essentially being forced into labor and that the 13th Amendment should protect them. And the Supreme Court said no. So right at the start of the Reconstruction Amendments, they took the economic rights right out of the Reconstruction Amendments, which arguably could have been in there from the jump. So when we talk about whether or not the Reconstruction project was good or bad, or whether it worked or not, there's a lot of complication there. I tend to think that the project worked, but I have, when I say expansive, I really mean that word, expansive. I have an expansive understanding of what the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, and then eventually the 19th Amendments are capable of doing. And so if you ask me, the Constitution is those four amendments and like some suggestions, right? Like people are like, oh, if those people are originalists, what are you, Ellie? And I'm like, I'm a 14th Amendmentist,
right?
Ologist, right?
Right. But I mean, like, I guess my point is that the creation and drafting of the Reconstruction Amendments, so the 13th Amendment, which ends slavery, the 14th Amendment, which creates equal protection under the law, and the 15th Amendment, which confers voting rights, which again, like, we tried it once and then it just was like destroyed. And then we had to like do it again, right? So it's like the 15th Amendment is an amazing document because it's like, we did it.
Like, right. Again. And we have to do it. We're going to have to do it again.
We're going to have to do it again. That, as insufficient as they are against the metric of what you're saying, which is like genuine multiracial pluralistic input and consensus, or just input, right? Feedback into conceptions of freedom to guide the lawmaking and constitution of a free, pluralistic, gender equitable, multiracial democracy, right? Like, they fall far short of that. But they're like wildly radical in comparison to the worldview of the founders.
Sure.
Right? And to me, I guess I would say, and I think you agree with this, you say as much in the book, like when you say I'm a 14th, it's like, it's also the case that their radical potential seems underrealized in the actual development of constitutional jurisprudence.
Yes.
That if you take seriously both the text of what they say and the context and milieu, there really was a vision for multiracial democracy, like genuinely present at the time.
Let's look at the 15th Amendment as to me, the OG example of this, because we can honestly see, for reasons like you were just alluding to, we can really see just how powerful the 15th Amendment is. We have the 15th Amendment at first. That gives us our first hit of blacks elected to Congress in the states where they were formerly enslaved them, hiring rebels, you know, a bunch of people, right? Then white Southerners see that and be like, we don't like that. So they take the 15th Amendment, they put it in a drawer, and they ignore it for 100 years. We then have to go through 100 years of reoppression unnecessarily until the Civil Rights Movement. And finally, in 1965, we get the Voting Rights Amendment. The Voting Rights Amendment is my pick for the most important piece of legislation in American history, because the Voting Rights Amendment, the Rolling Rights Act, is what makes the 15th Amendment real.
Right.
And that's what makes democracy real. If you ask me, you don't start the clock on American democracy until 1965, folks.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Because that's when we stopped being an apartheid state.
Yep.
So, okay, the Voting Rights Act is so good. And it's so good that by 1980, Ronald Reagan, who started his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and said that he thought that the Voting Rights Act humiliated the South, even Ronald Reagan had to agree to an expansion of the 15th Amendment over the objection of John Roberts. We'll get to that later. And so by 2008, barely 40 years after we are a functional apartheid state, we elect a black man president. That's how powerful the 15th Amendment is, folks.
Right.
And that's why once the black president was elected for a second time, so it wasn't a fluke, what's the first thing the white conservatives did? We got to get rid of the Voting Rights Act. We got to get rid of the 15th Amendment. The 15th Amendment is so powerful that that was the white people's response to Barack Obama, to take it away again. And they did. John Roberts, 2013, Shelby County versus Holder, eviscerates Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. The first thing white folks did once black people had political power was to take away the thing that was giving them political power, which was the right to vote. So to go back to the answer to your question, the radical potential of the Reconstruction Amendments is such that if they are just allowed to be,
right,
if they are just allowed to run and exist, we don't have to do a whole lot else in order to have a diverse, pluralistic, inclusive society. And the people who know that the most are white conservatives, because that's what they attack first when they want to put black people back in their place.
We'll be right back after we take this quick break.
Fact.
from Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
The project of limiting the franchise and the fights over it, right, have been one of the animating forces of American history and constitutional history. And you're even seeing it in this, the sort of, you know, the one person, one vote jurisprudence. And that's development too, which again, like one person, one vote, which is the inevitable, inescapable logical entailment of the Reconstruction Amendments and of the 15th Amendment, right? Like it has to be the case that you have one person, one vote. Itself was an incredibly controversial and fraught finding. And again, when you carry it forward, meets with a lot of resistance in modern conservative jurisprudence. And also, and I said this once, and people lost their mind. I had this monologue I once did about the Electoral College, where I said, if the Electoral College weren't explicitly in the Constitution, it would be an unconstitutional scheme. Like, I grew up in the Bronx when the city charter had like one borough president for all five boroughs, even though they had massively different populations. Can't do that. Like you couldn't create a statewide electoral college tomorrow and have it pass constitutional muster under the one person, one vote, again, which flows from the 15th Amendment and the 14th Amendment, the Reconstruction framework. But the thing that we use to elect the president, like, I mean, this to me is like the ultimate tension to your point about the sheer radicalness, or at least the like genuine vision of equitable multiracial democracy encoded in the Reconstruction Amendments, which is the country's second founding. And the vestigial systems that we have, they are in unbelievable tension.
Yeah, I mean, look, one of the pushbacks I get from my book, I get all kinds, right? But one of the consistent ones is, what do you think you could do better? How would you do better? And the first thing I always say is this, like, I would have popular election of the president. Boom. Better. Right?
It's an easy one.
Right? Like, ask me a hard question, please. One of the reasons, Chris, why I'm not in favor of a constitutional convention, of a new constitutional convention to fix some of the obvious problems in our Constitution, is because I do not believe a new constitutional convention would be seated on the basis of one person, one vote. If we have a new constitutional convention and there is a delegate from Wyoming, how many delegates do we think should be from California?
Right.
And if your answer is south of 60, you're just wrong. You're just wrong as a matter of population. If you have one delegate from Wyoming, we need at least 62 delegates from California to make that fair.
Right.
Okay, that's how outsized the power of small states are in the Electoral College. Now, Republicans will say, like, well, you know, that protects rural interests. No, it doesn't. No, the Electoral College does not protect rural interests. What it protects are people who live in cities in small states.
Yep.
Right. So like the interest of like Des Moines, Iowa,
yep,
is protected. The interest of Providence, Rhode Island is protected. Not rural interests, city dwellers living in small states. That's who's protected. The idea that somehow if we had of the Electoral College, people in small states would be overlooked. That's not necessarily true, because what we see in the primary situation is that people in small states are looked at quite heavily in certain primaries, not perhaps as heavily as in the bigger primaries, but you'll get a lot more primary attention if you're a Democrat or Republican. If you live in Illinois or Iowa or Indiana, three states of completely different sizes, than you will in New York, right? So like, come on. So the Electoral College doesn't lock in small state representation. What it does do is allow for perverse incentives where presidents of either party can ignore vast swaths of the country. Do you know, Chris, and I know you do, the state where Donald Trump got the most raw popular votes in 2020?
California, yeah.
California.
Right.
California.
Yeah.
When was the last time Republicans in California got... Donald Trump was willing to literally let California burn.
Right.
Burn. The most popular votes he got were from a state that he was willing to let burn, and he could do that because he wasn't going to win the state.
Right.
And the Electoral College creates perverse incentives where it's a winner-take-all system where if you're not going to win the state, you can functionally ignore it. And if the state is close, you have to fight for every blade of grass.
Right.
Which explains the difference between campaigning in Florida versus campaigning in Texas. Democrats can't, I mean, they don't, which is stupid, but like they can functionally ignore Texas every 4 years in a way they can't Florida, even though where did Joe Biden get the third most amount of popular votes? Texas.
Yeah. It's also to me, I mean, we've done entire podcasts on the Electoral College, which I just think is like one of those things. You know, there's some issues. I think there's like good arguments on both sides and the Electoral College is not one of them. Like there's no arguments on the other side. You know, every state in the union runs statewide elections without this scheme and it's fine. And it's not like if you're running for, like if you're running for governor of Missouri, do you ignore the rural areas? No, you do not.
Although that's also stupid, right, Chris? I mean, one of the other things I point out in the book is that federalism is dumb.
Okay, well, let's get to that. But my point only is that, like, we run the experiment in places all the time. And, like, it's not like, even in New York gubernatorial races, it's not like they ignore upstate. It's not like they ignore rural areas. Like, it's actually a huge deal to, like, go to every place. But to the point of federalism, which I think is, like, goes to your deeper point about just, like, the structure of the constitutional regime that we have being, like, bad. Which I think is your view.
Right.
I guess the question is like, what to do about it, right? So you don't want a constitutional convention.
Nope.
We have an amendment process that seems just hopelessly out of reach given the level of consensus you need to marshal for an amendment being outside the reach of really, I think, either party in current American polarization. Like, you just can't get it. So then the question is like, well, what do you do about it?
Yeah, so expand the court, yo. Look, we live in a justocracy. The thing, the Dobbs opinion from Alito should prove that more than anything, right? We live in a world where as long as you have five Supreme Court justices, that's all you need. Think about the things that we could or could not have depending on the Supreme Court. Apparently, the Supreme Court is what gets to decide whether or not women have access to healthcare. They decide whether or not you're allowed to bring guns on the subway. They decide whether or not you have to wear a mask on a plane during a pandemic. They decide whether or not your kids have to go to school or not during a pandemic with health protections or not. That's apparently an issue for the Supreme Court now. All right, so they get to decide at a granular level how American life operates. Laws that we pass through Congress that are signed by the president at this point in our history are suggestions that don't have meaning until the Supreme Court weighs in. The Supreme Court decides who gets into the country, who gets out of the country. The Supreme Court decides how much carbon we have in the air. If that's going to be the case, if we're going to live in a justocracy where nine justices get to decide all of these critical things about American life, well, then I take the Kermit the Frog and Muppets Take Manhattan option. I want more dogs and bears and chickens and cats and things. I want more people in the show. I don't want another four justices. That's small potatoes. I want another 20 justices to start. I want a 29-person court to start. Does that sound like a lot to you? It shouldn't. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is a 29-person court. Works just fine. We'll find enough chairs, all right? I promise. I'll make them myself. We'll find enough chairs. We'll have 29 people. They'll hear cases in three judge panels, and those people will be more diverse. You won't know who you're getting before you show up for panel. That's going to just have the appearance of impartiality a lot more. Maybe you won't have to take Jenny Thomas's call when she calls your office about your law because you don't know if her husband's going to be hearing your case. Mm. So that would be a benefit, wouldn't it? Right? We'd have the appearance of impartiality. The one litmus test I would have for these judges is that the 20 people I appoint would all have to agree that term limits are constitutional. Right now, I don't have five justices who agree with me that term limits are constitutional, so I need a constitutional amendment.
You're saying on the justices?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I can't get... John Roberts, do you think you should have to go home now? No.
Right.
That's how that conversation goes. I appoint 20 justices that agree that term limits are constitutional. Boom, term limits are constitutional. Now we've got 29 justices. They're all rotating off the court every 18 years. That, folks, fixes the confirmation process. The way it is right now, every time the party out of power loses a justice, it's an existential crisis for that party because they're going to serve for 30 years or more. You have term limits and you have 29 justices just rolling through. It's going to make the confirmation process a lot less politically fraught.
It also cloaks the stakes in such an insane way. Like, will someone die of a stroke or not? Will someone retire or not? Like, you can kind of tell, but a lot of it you don't. Like, we didn't know that Scalia, you know, and that was that part of it, like knowing when openings are happening and having that be part of the, like, broad popular mandate seems like such an obvious no-brainer to me. I mean, again, there's constitutional obstacles because, like, it's in there that they serve for life, right? Or good behavior, whatever the clause is.
Think about it this way, Chris, with just with the Dobbs situation, right? So Mississippi has a 15-week abortion ban. They go to the Supreme Court, ask them to approve their 16-week abortion ban. Then Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies. Then Mississippi changes their argument to actually just overturn Roe v. Wade straight up. Like, that's what happens in our current justocracy, that when one woman dying completely changes even what we're asking the court to
right.
do, that should not be. That was not what was intended, right? So no, a 29-person court at the very least means that instead of getting five justices on board for an opinion, you get 15 justices on board for an opinion. And that's going to be much harder. I've made this analogy before, but if you have to get five of your friends to go out to dinner, you might end up at some places, you know? You might end up at the club. You might end up at Thunder Down Under. You might, right? If you have to get 15 of your friends to go out to dinner, you're going to end up at Applebee's. You're going to go to Chili's. All right? That's how you end up at the Olive Garden, folks. Because when you have 15 people, you have much more moderate center mass opinions. You're going to have much narrower opinions. And you're going to have a much more moderate opinions because getting 15 people to agree on anything, even 15 people who are of the same party, is hard. Conservatives have 6 people on the Supreme Court. They only have 5 for their completely radicalized view of abortion. Imagine if they had to get 10 more to make a decision. I promise you it wouldn't be this radical. So you notice, Chris, I haven't even said that I want 20 justices who agree with me.
Right.
Court packing, court expansion, court reform, whatever you want to call it, is such an obviously good reform to the Supreme Court. I don't have to care. I would be willing, if Mitch McConnell would agree, which he won't because he's a bad person, but if Mitch McConnell would agree.
Well, also he won't agree because he doesn't, because of the reasons you're saying.
Because he's
which
winning.
The current system, he's winning right now. Yeah.
Right? But if I would agree that you give me 20 justices and Republican votes and we can split them 11-9. It's going to be 11-9 because that stuff they did with Garland, that ain't right.
Right.
We can't let that stand. But 11-9 would still leave them, if I'm doing the math correctly, with a conservative majority on the Supreme Court.
Right.
I would live with a 15-14 conservative majority on the Supreme Court if you gave me 29 justices. People always say, like, oh, well, if you add 20 justices, then Republicans will come back and add 20 more. Okay. 49-person court. 50, what does it matter? If the court is going to have this kind of power, then I want more people on it. I want more people from more different backgrounds. I want people from more law schools on it. I want some people who haven't been to law school at all on it. If the court is going to be a super legislature for life, then I want it to be a super legislature that has more of my people in it.
Hmm.
That's what I want.
Yeah, and the other thing that is interesting to consider about this. And again, this is one of those areas where, like, the way I feel about a lot of America right now is, like, I know the system is broken. I know some radical things need to change. I know we're in incredibly perilous situations. I know that we've strayed from certain, like, democratic, like, small d democratic precepts. I know that there's, like, this threat of minoritarian rule. There are certain reforms that are obvious to me, like, we should obviously have a popular election of the president, you know, strengthening the Voting Rights Act. Then there's other stuff where it's, like, I don't know. I just feel, like, completely, like, court right-sizing or court expansion is one of those where, like, I don't feel like I have certainty in either direction about which reforms I do or don't favor. But one thing that I've been thinking about a lot and I'm thinking about now in response to your argument is, and I was talking about this with our producers today, people forget that, like, as furious as liberals are right now, right? Can you imagine how freaking angry you would be if it leaked and one of the three Democratic appointees was on the Roe overturning side? And like, that was what happened in three successive occasions with Souter, Sandra Day O'Connor, and Justice Anthony Kennedy to the right, right? Like, they were like, we want to do this thing. They got their chance. They put people on the court, and the people on the court didn't vote their way. And everything subsequent to that has been about producing a vetting process and a pipeline that will ensure that never happens again. And so far, with maybe the exception of Roberts, honestly, from Roberts on, it's worked. They have gotten really good at this vetting process to be like, these are our people, and these people are going to be there when we need them on these important cases, right? That process itself, which I feel like is really messed up, would be much harder with more people. Like, just making sure that you've got these people who are absolutely going to do the thing you need them to do when they're there would be harder with more people.
Yeah, so a couple of points. One, I can't imagine what it would be like if that was in reverse, because I live in a world where Joe Manchin controls my party.
So, right, exactly, right. No, it's no, but it's that feeling, right? It's the feeling that you right. feel about Joe Manchin is how anti-abortion activists and many people on the right felt about, I mean, sure,
Sandra Day O'Connor.
Certainly Souter. I mean, what? I mean, Jesus. Like,
Souter just knifed them.
He just killed them. Yeah.
Right? So yes, I agree with that. But here's the thing. The reason why they're so effective is because they're vetted. It's because they're made. They're made this way.
They're both. That's right. That's exactly right.
Right? Yeah. Like, they go and identify these people yes. in law school. They train them up. They tell them where to work, who to clerk for, how to think, so that by the time they get to be Amy Coney Barrett, they have been produced to be this way. The Democrats have nothing comparable on their side. I like to make the point, though. I went to Harvard Law School, which is a pretty good law school.
I think, is that? Oh, yes, I've heard of that. Yeah.
it's near Boston. If I had been conservative, Leonard Leo, the head of the Federal Society, he would have taken me out to dinner. He would have been my friend.
Oh, dude, are you kidding? You would have, I mean, well, let me explain this for people who are listening. This is actually a key thing you need to understand, is that the sheer math here is an important thing to reckon with. There is equal demand out in the political world for credentialed, high-achieving, legal hotshots on the world of the right and the world of the left. Equal demand,
because
right. they're roughly, it's a roughly 50-50 universe, okay?
Right.
The supply is wildly asymmetrical, okay? So if you're one of the like 15 out and proud conservatives at Yale Law School, or however, 50 at Harvard, you know, I don't know what the numbers right. are. The world is your oyster. Like, you just go do whatever you want to do, whereas, you know, that's not at all. And say, go through the top 10 law schools. Like, they are producing a massive asymmetry in the politics of the people who do this, which is not to say they're graduating a lot of leftists. Like, a lot of people are just like, you know, want to go work at a corporate law firm and are going to vote for Joe Biden. But they are not producing a lot of like diehard anti-abortion MAGA people.
The Republicans are trying to create the next Antonin Scalia. That's how they got Neil Gorsuch. That's how they got Amy Coney Barrett. Democrats and liberals expect the next Thurgood Marshall to just show up, to just figure it out and show up on their doorstep and be like, hey, I'm Thurgood Marshall, too. And be like, oh, then they'll start talking to you, right? So like that's the asymmetry, but there's another reason for that.
But partly that's math too, isn't it?
Partially it's math, but it's also, this is the thing that I want to get into. It's because of how fractured the Democratic Party is itself when it comes to things like race, sex, gender, right. and social justice, right? Think about it this way. The conservatives have the Federalist Society, which is the organization that we're talking about that does the work of creating these people.
And Leonard Leo, who you talked about taking out dinner, is the sort of head of the Federalist Society, though maybe not in a titular sense, but in the sort of like spiritual sense, and has been the point person for Republicans on judges, specifically justices.
Right. He's the mascot for the Federal Society, right? And the thing is that all the other Republican constituent groups cede their Supreme Court picks and their judicial picks to the Federal Society. So if you go to the NRA and be like, who do you want for the Supreme Court? The NRA will say, well, like, whoever the Federal Society picks.
Yep.
So will the Chamber of Commerce. So will the evangelical right. Those are three wildly different groups, but they will all say, well, whoever the Federal Society says.
Well, that's what's so amazing about what they pulled off.
Try doing that as you're a Democrat. Try telling the NAACP, actually, we're going to pick the judges. You guys just support.
Right.
Try telling that to Lambda Legal. Try telling that to organized labor. Try telling that to the teachers union. Try telling all the Democratic constituencies, actually, no, I'm going to be the one who picks the Supreme Court justices, and you're just going to support it. Okay, Chris Coons? Okay, Dianne Feinstein? Okay? You're just going to support who me and Sherrilyn Ifill pick for the Supreme Court. Ain't going to happen. And so the asymmetry is not just the numbers. It's that other constituent groups in the Democratic Party don't trust the other people to have they don't trust for there to be one clearinghouse for new judges and new justices. We saw this a little bit during the Ketanji Brown Jackson confirmation hearings, where there were a lot of people, a lot of Black people specifically, who were just like, why are we picking another Harvard grad? Could we please have somebody from a non-Ivy League school? It's a completely reasonable point, right? Like,
well, that's, and to your point before about expanding the court, it's like, yes, we do, the court, and particularly I think Democratic presidents, right? And the progressive movement broadly, the broad center-left coalition, right? Has in this respect, and this has been true of judicial nominees by Joe Biden below the Supreme Court justice level, which have been, I think, quite good and quite diverse, you know, compared to the baseline, right? Not necessarily compared to the United States of America. But the Supreme Court it's incredibly uniform in some levels. Like, there is diversity in life experiences, diversity in race and gender, but it's like all Harvard and Yale. Like, Amy Coney Barrett's the big outlier at Notre Dame. Like, you know, it is a very small hothouse atmosphere and a very small pipeline that produces all of these people.
There's a reason why everybody knows each other, right? There's a reason why Ted Cruz is sitting up there in Ketanji Brown's confirmation hearings talking about going to law school, being on the law review with Ketanji Brown Jackson. There's a reason why a guy like me has stories about Tom Cotton.
Right.
Because we were in law school together, right? Like, everybody knows each other. Everybody.
I used to go to happy hours with Josh Hawley.
Right.
in the court when he clerked for Justice Roberts and Kate clerked for Justice Stevens. And I remember Josh. I just seemed like a perfectly nice dude, you know, have a beer, like make conversation.
Didn't know that he was thinking about killing all of you, right, when he was there. Like, it's an incestuous club is what it is, right? And again, it goes back to how you started your show. We're talking about 100 people. We're talking about 100 people from 3 or 4 law schools who have at this point in our history decided that they get to make the rules for the rest of us who nobody elected. Brett Kavanaugh could not win an election. Brett Kavanaugh was one of the least, it's easier to do it this way. The only Supreme Court justices who would have won an election are John Roberts and Ketanji Brown Jackson. None of the rest of them could have won an election. Like, that's the idea that these 9 people are the ones who get to decide these rules for the rest of us is, to me, ridiculous. And again, it's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. Like, I honestly think, Chris, and, you know, if people just understood what these justices were doing the way that I understand it, people would be as angry as I am.
Elie Mystel is the justice correspondent at The Nation. He's the Alfred Nobler Fellow at Type Media Center. He's author of the New York Times bestseller, Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution, which came out in March, which is really great. It's a great read. By the way, congratulations. The book has done really, really well. And, you know, a book doing well is like not necessarily super correlated to its quality. So like, people write great books that don't do well and people write crappy books that do well. But it is nice to see, like, you publish this on an independent publisher. It's not like you had some enormous like William Barr level, you know, machinery behind you to like book every morning show. And it's done great. It's awesome to see.
Dude, the funniest story is that, so I, you know, I was scheduled to be on your show, on some other MSNBC shows,
right, the
week
war.
Of launch. And the war happened the week that I launched the book.
Right.
I got bumped from everything.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't take a break for a week. I mean, it's like, yeah.
So I'm very, very thankful for all the people who have bought it and who are reading it. And, you know, I also need to thank Antonin Scalia, because without him, I never would have written it.
All right, Ellie. Thanks, man.
Thank you so much.
Once again, great thanks to Elie Mystel. He is just, he's something else, man. Just one of a kind, a great communicator and a really unique voice. And I always love talking to Elie. That was awesome. You could tweet us with the hashtag withpod, email withpod@gmail.com. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News. It's produced by Donnie Holloway, Tiffany Champion, and Brendan O'Melia, engineered by Bob Mallory, and features music by Eddie Cooper of the band Tempers. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to NBCNews.com/whyisthishappening.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.